Welcome to the Federal Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federal Society's Administrative Law and Regulation Practice Group, was recorded on Tuesday, May 1st, 2018, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federal Society members.
Welcome to the Federal Society's telephone conference call. This afternoon, we are discussing Professor Michael Rappaport's new essay on reforming administrative adjudication. My name is Laura Flint, and I'm the Deputy Director of Practice Groups here at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Today, we are happy to have with us Professor Michael B. Rappaport, Hugh and Hazel Darling Foundation Professor of Law and Director for the Center for the Study of Constitutional Originalism at the University of San Diego School of Law, and our moderator, Professor Jennifer L. Mascott, Assistant Professor of Law at the Antonin Scalia Law School. After hearing from our speakers, we'll go to audience question and answer. Thank you for speaking with us, Professor Mascott. The floor is yours.
Great. Thank you so much. Today, we're privileged to have on the call Professor Michael Rappaport, and in addition to his work at the University of San Diego Law School and at the Center for the Study of Constitutional Originalism, Professor Rappaport also blogs regularly at the Law and Liberty blog and blogs periodically on the Originalism blog. His work, some of it with his frequent co-author, Professor John McGinnis, has really been foundational in helping to develop originalist interpretive methodology through Professor Rappaport's work on the theory known as original methods originalism, and his more recent work addressing originalism in the language of the law. Today we'll be discussing Professor Rappaport's most recent article, Classical Liberal Administrative Law in a Progressive World, where Professor Rappaport explains how classical liberal administrative law principles, or basically stricter adherence to the separation of powers, can be feasible even within a large modern administrative state. And so, Mike, can you tell us a little bit more about your proposal to make modern government more consistent with separation of powers without necessarily grinding modern government to a halt?
Sure. Thanks, Jen. So one of the significant problems with modern administrative law is that it does not conform to the separation of powers. Administrative agencies are given not only executive power, but also judicial and legislative power. And in a recent paper that you mentioned, I argue that this is not necessary. Even in our modern world with big government, it would be possible to employ a much stricter separation of powers than at present. Now, in the paper, I employ the Reins Act, the elimination or reduction in deference to administrative agencies, and a new set of Article III administrative courts to do this. Today, at least in my talk here, I want to focus on the Article III administrative courts aspect of this. So one of the key features of present administrative law is that agencies exercise significant judicial power. Most importantly, ALJs adjudicate administrative law cases, and these decisions are then reviewed by agency officials, such as the head of the agency. Thus, adjudication is conducted by political officials, who in many cases are subject to review by the president. It's true that these agency adjudications are typically subject to review in Article III courts, but that review is limited since significant deference is conferred as to legal issues, factual questions, and policy matters. Now, this arrangement is often justified on the ground that Article III courts do not have the expertise to decide these cases and would not have the ability to decide the large volume of these cases. And given existing institutions, this claim that Article III courts are not efficient enough has a lot of truth to it. But the departures from separation of powers principles also have significant legitimacy costs. Administrative agencies are controlled by agency officials who also make the decisions as to what enforcement actions to bring and what rules to enact. This arrangement allows bias into the process. For example, the agency can bring an enforcement action knowing that it will decide the matter and therefore can hold against the defendant. It allows the agency to be the judge in its own case. Thus, under existing administrative institutions, we're faced with a kind of efficiency-legitimacy trade-off. But the trade-off is not inevitable. It could be greatly reduced through a reform of administrative adjudication. Under the reform, adjudications would be conducted by Article III administrative courts. These courts would replace the existing ALJs in formal adjudications. Also, since they are Article III courts, their adjudicative decisions could not be reversed by the agency. Thus, adjudication would be genuinely independent. Now, the Article III administrative judges could also have expertise, you know, even though they're Article III courts. The judges should be divided into three groups. One group would have expertise as to economics, another as to science, and a third as to medicine. And in this way, the judges would have specialized knowledge about the matters they adjudicate. These judges, however, would not have the agency tunnel vision that ALJs and agency adjudicators now exhibit. The Article III judges would not hear cases only from a single agency. Instead, they'd hear them from a variety of agencies in their area of expertise. The judges would also be able to handle the large volume of cases that ALJs decide. There's no reason why these judges could not employ many of the streamlined procedures that existing ALJ adjudications employs. For example, many agencies do not use hearsay rules. And by employing many of these streamlined procedures, the Article III administrative courts could be extremely efficient. Well, how then would these courts function? When there was an administrative adjudication against an individual, the agency and the individual would appear before the court. The court would then reach a decision based on the evidence. In some areas, the court would not give any deference to the agency's position. Findings as to adjudicative facts, the type of facts that involve the specific actions the parties took, should not be given any deference since they involve only limited expertise and would involve testimony given before the court. Findings as to legal issues, such as those governed by Chevron, should also not be given any deference. I should say that I don't believe that there should be Chevron deference even under our existing court system, because I don't believe non-legal expertise is very useful for interpreting statutes and regulations. But even if one believed that non-legal expertise was useful for such interpretations, the administrative courts would have that expertise. Findings as to other issues, however, involve more expertise, and therefore deference couldn't be entirely eliminated. Findings as to legislative facts about how groups of people behaved in the past or are likely to behave in the future, do require more expertise. While agencies typically enjoy significant deference in this area at present, being reviewed under a substantial evidence or an arbitrary capricious standard, I would significantly reduce that deference. I would employ a standard that I call modest deference. Finally, there are findings related to policy. Such policy determinations are now given significant deference under hard look review. I favor actually eliminating policymaking by agencies in the adjudicative context for a variety of reasons. Instead, agencies should do policy through rulemakings. In that way, congressional review under the RAINS Act could place limits on policymaking. And here I'm referring to another aspect of my proposal that I'm not focusing in on now, but so if we had the RAINS Act, we could have policymaking done through rulemaking and Congress would have some review in the process. Now, some people believe that it'd be simply too difficult to eliminate policymaking in the adjudicative context. And if one held that position, then one could restrict policymaking in several ways. In the case of independent agency commissions, one could require policy findings to be approved by a supermajority of commissioners. In the case of executive branch single-headed agencies, one could require approval of the findings by OMB. And in both cases, one could modestly reduce the degree of deference courts give as to policymaking under hard look review. Okay, so that's my proposal as to administrative adjudication. Let me then conclude my discussion of these institutional reforms that I'm proposing by talking about another Article III administrative court, an appellate administrative court. Now, this court would be similar to the Article III administrative trial courts that I've mentioned, in that individual judges would have expertise in the three areas of economics, science, and medicine, but would also be independent of agency control or review. This court, however, would hear initial challenges to legislative regulations that are issued by the agencies, and then the parties would be able to appeal those decisions to the circuit courts. The system would have the advantage of having independent judges with expertise review agency rulemakings. I admit, though, it would also have a disadvantage in that it would involve additional levels of judicial review. We'd have review of legislative regulations, first by administrative courts and then by circuit courts. Now, perhaps this additional review would be worth the cost. Perhaps not. I don't take really a formal position on it. I think it's something well worth considering. But I do think one could take some actions to reduce those additional costs. And, for example, one could limit judicial review by the appellate administrative courts to issues where those courts have the most to contribute, issues such as where legislative facts are involved or where policy determinations are involved. One could exclude such courts from reviewing other issues where they have less to contribute, such as issues involving agency procedure or statutory interpretation. So in that way, those courts wouldn't be a full level of additional administrative review or additional judicial review. They'd be kind of doing limited things. In conclusion, I really think that this arrangement would be both principled and practical. It would promote a much greater separation of powers, but it could still operate in the modern world of big government. I do admit it would require some significant changes to our administrative institutions and law, but in my view, its benefits would be well worth the cost.
Well, great. Thank you, Mike, so much for walking us through the proposal. And for anybody who has not had a chance to do so, I encourage everybody to read Mike's full article. It's up on the Social Science Research Network under his account. And in it, he describes a lot more fully not only these proposals, but also some ideas that Mike has regarding the non-delegation doctrine, as well as some ways that the RAINS Act currently before Congress can be modified to make it perhaps a little bit more effective and less subject to manipulation by administrative agencies. But just asking some follow-up questions today, the title of your piece refers to classical liberal administrative law. And can you just, for starters, explain to the listeners what it is that you mean by classical liberal administrative law, kind of in a nutshell?
Well, I think of classical liberalism as the belief that, you know, individual freedom is the primary political value. And I think of classical liberalism as the view that, you know, our law and government should be set up to protect such individual freedom, but also do some additional things, protect a variety of areas where individual freedom has is part of an important system, like the system of religious liberty, the system of freedom of speech, the market, and where the government also sort of pursues very sort of limited public goods. Mm-hmm. So that would be classical liberalism. So what role would there be for administrative law in such a world? And mm-hmm. and if we were in a classical liberal world, I think administrative law would look really very different than not only our existing law, but even the, you know, would be more limited than even the arrangement that I talk about in mm-hmm. the paper. But we don't live in that world. We live in a world of big government, and it's often argued we can't have the separation of powers, we can't do any of these things because it would be impractical, it just couldn't operate our institution. So what I'm trying to do is to get as close to that mm-hmm. world of individual freedom and limits on government as possible, given the constraints of the fact that we've got this big government world. And I think we can get a lot closer to the kinds of individual freedom I'm talking about mm-hmm. Through my proposal than a lot of people think we can.
Great. That's very helpful. You mentioned at one point in your summary of your proposal that this new system of Article 3 adjudication of administrative issues would mean that we can replace the current ALJs within agencies who are overseeing formal adjudication. I mean, are you saying to wholesale just get rid of that current system? I mean, because if we see adjudication, executive adjudication is just simply applying law to facts. I mean, that's been around in some form since 1789. Is there really no role within the current framework for any kind of adjudication within agencies themselves? I mean, what about licensing or permitting or initial benefits eligibility determinations?
Right. So that's a good question. I guess, you know, there's a lot of aspects to that question. And let me just focus in on one of them, which is in my proposal, I talk about what is the types of issues that are now currently dealt with through formal adjudication.
Mm-hmm.
So, and you know, we have a pretty good idea, although there is some disagreement about what exactly formal adjudication is, which, you know, certain proceedings that agencies engage in, is it really formal adjudication or not? But I would focus in on that first and replace that with my system. Now, once you did that, and then that's a pretty tall order.
Right.
Right? So, So one might then ask a variety of questions about the types of things that agencies do, which are informal adjudication.
Mm-hmm.
And that is a great range of things, informal adjudication. Especially as defined by the APA, it's pretty much everything other than, you know, formal adjudication or rulemaking. So some of that stuff I might want to see go through this process. Some things, you know, wouldn't have to.
Sure.
And, you know, so that sort of raises, you know, how do you figure out what ought to go in that, ought to go through these independent administrative courts or not? And I guess the another aspect of the of your question that this sort of raises is, are we talking about the Constitution now? So some people have the position that certain things have to be in Article III courts under, let's say, the original meaning of the Constitution, or one might be advocating something like what I'm saying on kind of political principles grounds. So the way I wrote the paper and the way I've been sort of arguing it today is just kind of on political principles grounds.
Sure.
But I think there is a kind of originalist argument one could make for this. I don't really have a fully worked out view on exactly how far I think the judicial power goes. One sort of tentative view I have about all this is that when we're talking about at least sort of common law private rights, rights to the contract, property, protection from torts, and the government's taking actions that would interfere with those rights, if let's say the government were a private party and they did that, the individual could sue them, then there's a pretty reasonable argument, I think, to be made, as I say, tentatively, that those have to be in Article III courts. The courts developed, Supreme Court doctrine has developed a whole set of exceptions, like the public rights exception, which I'm very skeptical of. But so one might sort of apply an original meaning kind of analysis and then say, okay, we could get a lot closer to the original meaning with the arrangement that I'm talking about.
Sure. So it sounds like what you're saying is probably the Constitution requires a certain percentage of what's currently before agencies to go to Article III courts. But even in addition to that, you're saying as a policy matter, even for things that might be appropriate within administrative agencies, the system can still be improved by having adjudicators that are more independent from the agencies that are trying to right now bring adjudicative matters right within the agencies themselves. And that certainly sounds like it makes a lot of sense. I have a couple of questions about sort of practically how this system would come about. I mean, do you think you know, how would Congress, for example, get past any accusations that, oh, well, you know, we're just trying to create new Article 3 positions so that the president or the Senate, you know, are able to pack the courts? Do you think it'd be appropriate to just phase something like this in gradually rather than getting rid of all of the executive branch ALJs all at once? Do you think it'd be appropriate maybe for Congress and the president to enact legislation that's just prospective so that the Congress that's creating these new positions isn't also involving the Senate, who would be confirming the judges? Or what do you think would be, from a practical perspective, a way that there could be political support for this kind of proposition?
Yeah, I haven't actually thought a great deal about this. I know, you know, there's been some proposals that have actually been tied to kind of the idea of court packing in favor of Article III administrative judges. And I don't want to advocate that on my system on that ground.
Sure.
I see it as being a matter of sort of long-term principle. So
right.
I think, but I have thought a little bit about it, and I think one could do it over time. You know, we don't know who the president is going to be in 2020 or 2024, and in any event, it would make sense to do this gradually. So one could set up the system so that certain positions open up.
Mm-hmm.
You know, an office gets created in 2021, and then additional ones 2022, and so on, and then additional offices in 2024. So you could have a system where, you know, if you wanted to spread the appointments over time.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, our political system often doesn't work that way. You know, but
right.
Well, part of the reasons why, you know, a party in control might want it is in order to pack things, and that's certainly been done a lot through American history. But you wouldn't have to do it that way, and I think it would work better if one sort of had the, for a variety of reasons, one gradually introduced this, and that would also allow, you know, you to avoid accusations of just trying to court pack.
That makes a lot of sense. I also have a question for you about, you know, sort of the justifications for making the change. One of the things that you pointed out in your remarks and that you talk about on the paper is this concern about perhaps inherent bias now, because within administrative agencies, we've got the agency that's trying maybe to, you know, they're passing they're promulgating the rules, and then they're bringing the enforcement action against a regulated party, and then, you know, ALJs within that agency are hearing the case. And so one would think that, of course, the agency's own adjudicators are going to be biased in favor of the agency that's bringing action before them. But in connection with the current ALJ Appointments Clause case that the Supreme Court is considering, this term Lucia versus SEC, some professors have done some empirical research that at least suggests that within the SEC, actually the SEC doesn't win any more when it brings actions within its own agency than it does when it brings actions directly into a district court. So if that research is correct empirically, does that, you know, undercut your argument for why we need this system and why your system would make things less biased?
Right. So I'm aware of some of that research. I'm also aware of claims where, and I just don't know much about it, but I've seen claims where the SEC wins 100% of the time.
Mm-hmm.
When it goes through its own ALJs, and like 50% of the time when it goes through courts. So, I mean, I don't have a position on any of that. I will say that, you know, it's sort of interesting how the SEC decides whether to bring something before its ALJs or to bring
mm-hmm.
something in courts. One could actually imagine a situation where they have equal winning percentages,
mm-hmm.
and still there would be bias operating. For example, I don't know if this makes if this fits the facts or not, but one could bring the easy cases, the stronger cases,
mm-hmm.
in courts,
mm-hmm.
and the weaker cases before your own ALJs, and one could have equal winning percentages, but one, but that would still exhibit bias because you shouldn't have equal winning percentages because one group of cases
right.
are easy and one are harder. So I don't know. There's some question about, you know, how much bias is exhibited by ALJs in and of itself. I think you have to actually step back and look at the whole system.
Mm-hmm.
So first of all, it's not simply ALJs who are adjudicating these things. They
right.
they then get reviewed by the whole board or the whole commission, especially in independent agency situations. And there we know the people who are doing the adjudication are also bringing have also approved the enforcement actions.
Right.
And, you know, I just think it's sort of outrageous in administrative law. It actually goes back to this case, Withrow versus Larkin,
mm-hmm.
Where the Supreme Court, in a Justice White opinion, if memory serves, says,
yes.
Mm-hmm. It's fine for the same entity to both adjudicate and bring the enforcement action. And I simply think, you know, that's just outrageous. That's allowing somebody to be a judge in their own case. And there's a real sort of, you know, intuitive psychological understanding here that maybe differentiates. In that case, for example, the court said, oh, well, judges are often involved in other circumstances in reviewing matters. They might decide at the state level, for example, whether or not a case can a criminal case can be brought. So they'll have the sort of preliminary review, they'll approve that, and then the criminal trial. Is that problematic? But that's a very different thing than what the agencies do. When you decide that you're going to prosecute somebody, it's a natural sort of human reaction that you're then involved in a bit of a war,
mm-hmm.
and you want to win. That's
mm-hmm.
a very different thing than if you're a judge who's reviewing somebody else's decision to prosecute and you're saying, okay, it passes some minimal test, and then maybe you adjudicate at the trial as well. Those, you're not invested. You haven't made a decision
mm-hmm.
at an early stage that this person is guilty or should be liable for this action. And so I really think it's extremely problematic, not so much at the ALJ level, but to some extent at the ALJ level, but also at the head of the agency. Now, if you talk about ALJs, even if we considered them to be completely impartial,
right.
they're operating in a world where they have an agency's viewpoint, where all of their decisions are reviewed by a single agency. They don't
mm-hmm.
want to be reversed. That's a natural human reaction as well. So I have some concerns about the ALJs, but... and the existing system introduced them as a check, and I think it's great. There's some check, but not a good enough check.
Yeah, because it sounds like what you're saying is at the end of the day, if the agency can really reverse the decision made by the ALJ without giving a lot of deference, you can have the most impartial ALJ, the APA has some separation of functions protections where ALJs are not supposed to then also be involved in the investigation side of a case. But at the end of the day, you know, the commissioners or the head at the top are involved both in bringing the action and ultimately in approving the adjudication. So it seems, you know, hard to ever completely get away from that bias. So, you know, your proposal obviously is to take the adjudication completely out of the agency. And you talk about wanting to have administrative judges who are basically Article III judges but have a certain amount of expertise. And so I have a question about how we get expert judges. Is that just when the president gets ready to make an appointment, he or she looks at somebody's credentials, or are we talking about a merit-based system where we've got certain tests people need to take or, you know, maybe a centralized board who's evaluating these candidates? How do we get this expertise in these judges?
Right, right. Well, that's a good question, and it would definitely involve sort of something of a new system in a way. So at present, how does it work with ALJs? People who, you know, sort of apply for the ALJ positions, they take a test, and then they're assessed based on the test and based on their years of experience and so on, and then the board decides, you know, where to put them. And so it's somewhat merit-based. And then the agency gets to pick from, typically, and there's different ways, but then the agency gets to pick from the top three candidates.
Mm-hmm.
Which, if you think about it, the agency wants somebody who's going to further their own agenda. They're going to pick the person in the top three who's most in accord with what they think their agenda is. So that's how it works at present. I think there's a lot to be said for that arrangement. I think we'd want to change it a little bit. We'd want not only to take into account, as they do now, sort of legal expertise, but also if we're picking science, you know, the judges in the science category, for example,
mm-hmm.
we'd want to pick people who have some science expertise. That could come from maybe, you know, master's degrees that people have. It might come from what they've done in their career. If they've been litigating in an area where they had to develop some of that scientific expertise, or both. And so they could be assessed by a board based on their legal and their scientific expertise, based on tests. Now, what I'd like to see is the president make these appointments with the advice and consent of the Senate, but I'd like, and I don't think you could require constitutionally the president to pick from a list of three people or five people, but I'd like to see that sort of be the voluntary arrangement. The Senate can, of course, say, look, we'd like to see someone from this list, and unless we're absolutely convinced the person you picked is just really great, we want to insist that we're happy to confirm, you know, anyone on this list, but we're not. So that's part of a kind of political process at work, and in that way you would both have sort of the merit system operating, but you'd also have the political checks of presidential appointment and advice and consent.
And I guess, and who would be the one who would decide? I mean, because you threw out a couple of possible ways that you might judge expertise based on what degrees they have, based on what they've done in their careers. In your vision, would Congress, when it enacts the legislation creating these new positions, also be putting down some basic ideas about what the qualifications would be? It wouldn't just be completely up to the senators,
right,
in this political process or the board to figure it out. Congress would give some specific guidance.
Right, and they have a process now, which I think is, you know, I haven't studied it closely, but it seems to me to be, you know, make some sense, where people are taking tests and they're looking at years of experience. And so I think we could take that process and of assessment of the candidates and build upon it, and the main thing we'd want to build into it is taking this additional expertise into account. We'd want to make sure for the science judges that they've had a science background, and for the economics
mm-hmm.
judges that they've had an economics background. And it might be that people actually almost want to make this a career thing. Lots of people have joint degrees, and one of the things they could use with their joint degrees for would be to become an Article III administrative judge.
And one of the things also that you touched on in your introductory remarks was a little bit about the issue of deference. And so if we're talking about the category of administrative judges who are replacing the ALJs in the current formal adjudicative system, you know, you had said you would eliminate Chevron and Auer deference when these new administrative judges are looking at interpreting the agency regulations, I guess, that they'd have to apply in these particular adjudicative proceedings. But how would the Article III judges fit within the Article III system currently? Would they basically be at a trial court level where then their decisions are reviewed directly by a circuit court? And if so, what level of deference would the federal circuit courts give to these administrative judges?
Yeah, so I go into some of this in the paper, and it gets it's sort of a new arrangement, so it gets a sort of a little complicated. But so we've got the level at the trial court, and then how much deference should the administrative judges give to the agency.
Mm-hmm.
And in some cases, I think nothing, like Chevron.
Okay.
And mm-hmm. I would eliminate, you know, sort of for legal issues. And in other areas, such as legislative facts or policymaking, I would have some deference. And the reason you'd have some deference is there is some expertise involved, but it would be less deference than we have now because these administrative courts have more expertise. Then when there's judicial review to the circuit courts from these administrative courts, I think the circuit courts should be giving some deference to the administrative courts.
Mm-hmm.
So, and it gets a little bit involved to talk about how it would all work, but I think it can basically be captured by the idea that the circuit court would only reverse the decision of the administrative court if they're concluded, if after giving deference to the administrative court, they conclude that they were wrong. So we would have with respect to some issues, we give deference both to the agency and to the administrative court. And for some issues, I don't think I wouldn't give deference at all. So for legal issues, the agency would get no deference and the administrative court would get no deference.
And what about you? You also made a reference to administrative appellate courts reviewing challenges to legislative rules. Can you talk a little bit about how those courts would fit within the current Article III system?
Right. So a lot of what goes on now is rulemaking, legislative regulations that are enacted, right? We
mm-hmm.
all know that most of the rules that govern people these days at the federal level are not made by Congress. They're made by agencies. So that's enormously important. And there's a whole sort of side of that I've mentioned a couple of times, but I'd like to see a kind of Reins Act. A new and improved Reins Act operating there. But when you get a legislative regulation, it's going to be there's going to be a lot of issues involved with respect to legislative fact and policy making, as well as legal issues. And there's an argument there, I think, for having expert administrative judges at the appellate level. So you'd have a legislative regulation, and depending on how the system of reviewability operates, but let's just assume it gets immediately challenged,
mm-hmm.
the challenge might go to the appellate administrative court. And again, for legislative facts and for policymaking, you would give some deference, but less deference than under the existing system. And in that way, you've actually got an independent court.
Mm-hmm.
They're a court that's, you know, not tied to the agency, but they have some expertise. And then you would have review by, you know, an appeal from that court to the circuit court. And who would give, again, the court, the administrative court, some deference as to some issues and no deference as to other issues, like legal issues. There's a disadvantage to that because you've got now two levels of a court system.
Mm-hmm.
The typical legislative regulation now just goes from the agency to the circuit court, and this would involve going to the administrative court and then to the circuit court. But it might be worth it because we would get both an independent decision maker and somebody with expertise looking at the matter. So I'm not sure about that, but I think there's a lot to be said for at least thinking real hard about that.
And a lot of the things would continue to remain the same in the sense that, when the first level administrative appellate court looks at the rule, they'd still, I mean, they have an extra level of expertise, as you've mentioned, but they also would still have the statement of basis and purpose in the current informal rulemaking situation I think you talk about in your paper that would also help to kind of guide them and have where the agency would still have gone through some of that information gathering phase.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. the, you know, I would build upon the existing system. So they would just be, the administrative court would just be in a better position to kind of assess what the, you know, the strength of the arguments made by the agency, because they would have more expertise.
Well, that's great. Well, one of the things I say again is I love about the full paper, which I encourage all of our listeners to take a look at, is that you not only have these proposals about the new Article III judges, but this, you know, this review here is to work in tandem with some additional proposals that you have about how to implement kind of a modified Reins Act system so that Congress is actually has more role even in the development of the rules in the first place. And you have some non-delegation ideas. But before we get into those, I thought now would be a good time to open the floor to questions if any of our callers have specific follow-up questions about your particular ALJ or Article III judge proposals.
That'd be great.
Let's go to audience questions. In a moment, you'll hear a prompt indicating that the floor mode has been turned on. After that, to request the floor, enter star, then the pound key. When we get to your request, you will hear a prompt, and then you may ask your question. We'll answer questions in the order in which they are received. Again, to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound key on your telephone keypad. Looks like we have one question pending, so let's go to that first audience question.
Hi, this is Mike Doherty, and I'm the CEO of LabMD. We're involved in quite the fight with the Federal Trade Commission over cybersecurity, and we went through an ALJ case. And sort of my real-world comments and your observations are that, you know, we thought the ALJ was incredible. We thought it was the lucky break, and we thought the whole big picture was everyone knew. And Josh Wright has written about this in his presentation from 2013, The Need for Limits on Agency Discretion, that the FTC has a 100% win rate in overturning their ALJ. Since then, there's been 1-2 tie. So that it reduces – the ALJ isn't the topic. It's the fact that they're only – it's been – the ALJ has been weaponized. Whether he's biased or not, if you get one that rules against the agency, it's a weapon, and everyone knows it if you're outside. And that's why the lawyers just tell all the CEOs like me, you're toast, there's no due process, it's a racket, it's a, you know, it's just, you're dead, so don't even try. And then, interesting enough, when we got to oral argument in front of Choplat in the 11th Circuit, they argued that they do get to rulemake during adjudication. And that the judges, we've been waiting for ruling for a year. I'd love to get this oral argument transcript to you. It's incredible when people are actually watching the FTC say this to the 11th Circuit. Yes, yes, we just rulemate when we adjudicate, and we don't have to set anything up. So I think it's more than just a debate of rulemaking. I think it's a racket and a scheme, quite frankly, when you get out in the macro. And I appreciate your comments, and I thank you for addressing this issue.
Well, that's very interesting. Yeah, I think that I mean, obviously I'm not familiar with the case, but that's, it's exactly the kind of problems that I think the existing system allows. I mean, one way to think about it is there's just so many different levels where the agency has discretion, right? So if you go before the ALJ and the agency wins, well, that's great for them. They've won and that's going to be helpful to them. But if they lose, then, of course, they can reverse the ALJ. And, of course, there's judicial review, but judicial review gives a lot of deference in the present situation. And so if an agency wants to do problematic things, wants to play fast and loose with the law, wants to pursue a political agenda, it's got a lot of sort of policy space in order to be able to do that. So that's the real danger in the existing system, and I think that the system of administrative of independent Article III courts would sort of place some real limits on what they can do. It would still allow, you know, the expertise aspects to agencies, but it would place much more significant limits on what they can do. So I think that example that you give is exactly the kind of thing where this system makes some sense.
Again, to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound key on your telephone keypad. While we wait for our next question, I'll make a brief announcement. Our next Teleforum conference call is scheduled for tomorrow, Wednesday at 1 p.m. That call will be on Deference Doctrines and the Clean Water Act and will feature Professor Jonathan H. Adler, Timothy Bishop, and moderator Tony Francois. Remember to keep an eye out for emails announcing upcoming Teleforum calls and to consult the full schedule of our upcoming calls on the Federalist Society's website. Also available there are podcasts of previously recorded Teleforum calls you may have missed. Looks like we still don't have another audience question. Again, press star, then the pound key. Professor Mascott, do you have any more questions?
Sure. So, Mike, I appreciate you explained to us a little bit about how your proposal would work. One of the things that your paper advertises, though, about the proposal is that it can still work in the modern system, which would suggest that it's going to be at least somewhat efficient. And I guess I just wanted to play devil's advocate and push back and ask you if you think that's realistic, if we've got to send all of these now new positions through Senate confirmation, and then, as you say, at certain points there's an extra level of review. I mean, is it actually true that this system's going to be compatible with an efficient modern administrative state? Because, I mean, as you pointed out in your exchange with the questioner, there's so many points right now where agencies are getting so much deference, and we've sort of deferred to that in kind of the name of getting things done. I just wonder how realistic you think your proposal is in continuing to allow the administrative state to get things done.
Right, right. Well, that's a good question, and I could imagine people who like the existing amount of deference and administrative discretion sort of objecting to this. But as I say, I think the legitimacy costs of the existing system sort of are too great,
right,
to allow that. So where would this system place limits? So one aspect is the appointment of administrative judges, right, and it'd have to go through the president with the advice and consent of the Senate. And obviously, in setting it up, there might be a bit of a backlog, and that's why you'd want to set it up and sort of gradually go through it. But right now, there's what? Outside of the Social Security area, and I think Social Security disability, we can talk about that separately if you're interested. But what? There's about 300 ALJs that are out there, and so if one...
It might even be as few as 150. It might actually be lower.
Excuse me?
It might even be the number actually that some have been saying is even lower, 150 ALJs outside of Social Security.
Okay, well, I'm just going based on some literature that I looked at.
Oh, I see.
That suggested 300 and 1,300 ALJs. But if it's 150,
That's even better for you,
even
I guess.
Better.
Yeah.
I think there's some disagreement about exactly
right.
Who
could
fits
be
into these categories, but so if one did that gradually, that's not an undue number when compared to the much larger number of district judges throughout the United States and and the like. So now, what about the actual procedures that occur in these formal adjudications, which would now be in Article III courts? And I think a great deal of what the efficiencies of administrative adjudication could be employed before Article III judges. There's no requirement, for example, that you have hearsay rules. There's no reason why you can't have much more streamlined procedures. So. So it's not obvious on the face of it, let's put it that way, that these adjudications would take any more time than the adjudications that occur at present. Now, you might want to build some in on the grounds that we want additional checks, and that would be a sort of separate decision that we're willing to incur the additional cost, time costs here because of concerns about legitimacy. But if you wanted to keep the existing sort of trade-off there and just change the nature of the incentives and who the people were making the decisions, I don't think you would have that much of a if any, additional sort of bottleneck in the system.
I see. And one of the things you talk about in your paper that kind of moves beyond this Article 3 judge proposal is you do have some ideas for how to limit the amount of discretion that agencies have initially in rulemaking. And so you talk a little bit about the issue of the non-delegation doctrine. Can you just describe briefly for callers your thoughts on whether there's a need to tighten up the amount of power that's delegated to agencies and what an administrable standard might be for a non-delegation doctrine?
Right, right. So of course, the non-delegation doctrine is the idea that the amount of discretion that is given to agencies has some limits on it. The principle that the court has employed for a long time now, even preceding the New Deal, is the discretion has got to be limited by an intelligible principle. Unfortunately, what's happened since the New Deal is the court has really relaxed that standard of an intelligible principle, and it has pretty much approved everything as an intelligible principle. So for a lot of people, the thought is that there's no real non-delegation limit, even though people like Justice Thomas and Justice Gorsuch would like to see one reintroduced.
Mm-hmm.
I think the real problem in this area, and I think it's the reason why, for example, Justice Scalia was not interested in having a stricter non-delegation doctrine, is coming up with some administrable principle that would say, okay, this amount of discretion is allowed to the agency, but no more. And Justice Scalia said, look, this is a question of degree, not of principle,
mm-hmm.
and as a result, you know, the courts are just going to be deciding this on an ad hoc basis, and Justice Scalia, of course, hated that more than almost anything. what could we use as a principle? I mean, one possible idea that I have is that we take a certain amount of discretion and that people are familiar with, and that's something is agency discretion exercised under a public interest standard. So an agency has to operate and do stuff, exercise its discretion in accord with the public interest. That's considered normally to be a lot of discretion, but it's not, you know, unlimited amount of discretion. So since that's a familiar standard, we would have that standard. And we would say you have to actually have less than that amount. In other words, the public interest standard is too much. You have to be, but at least we're familiar with what that standard is. And so as long as Congress gave to the agency less than that amount of standard, it would pass the non-delegation doctrine review. That might be, I don't go into it in detail, but it seems to me that's at least has the virtue of identifying a standard that we have some experience with and then saying that that should be the maximum amount or not even the maximum amount. That would, if you gave the public interest amount of discretion to an agency, that would be a unconstitutional delegation. You have to give less.
Yeah, so that's a bridge too far, and it's got to be some scope of discretion that's less than that. Do we have any other questions from callers?
We do not. Again, to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound key on your telephone keypad.
Well, Mike, since we have several extra minutes, would you be willing to talk to us then about the RAINS Act side of your proposal? I mean, basically, there's a proposal before Congress now where Congress would actually have to approve certain major rules promulgated by agencies. So again, another way to sort of limit discretion is at the end of the day, agencies have to put forward rules, major rules at least, that Congress is going to approve. You have some ideas for how to modify and improve the RAINS Act standard that you think would work nicely in conjunction with your Article 3 judge proposals. Would you tell us a little bit about the RAINS Act side of things?
Sure. Sure. So I'll just go into this in a kind of very more general way. So I think the RAINS Act, I mean, what it does is it decides what's a sort of major rule. And for major rules, let's say rules that have, what, more than $100 million effect on the economy, those have to be submitted to Congress for review. And Congress is a limited period of time where it through limited debate, gets to decide on an up or down vote whether or not to approve that rule. So if Congress approves the rule and then the president would sign it, the rule goes into effect. And if Congress votes it down, if you even want it, either house votes it down, or the president were to veto it and the veto were not to be overridden, that would be the rule could not go into effect. So that actually places a very significant limit on administrative agencies, because the most consequential, the most important, from at least an economic perspective, rules would be subject to congressional approval. The problem is with the existing RAINS Act is there's a lot of sort of manipulations that could occur. So if you had, let's say, a standard that said $100 million effect on the economy, the agencies would then have an incentive to say, oh, this wouldn't have a $100 million effect. This would have an $80 million effect.
Mm-hmm.
And so what would one do about that? Now, under the existing system, there are situations where, for example, the executive order on cost-benefit analysis only applies to something like major rules, and OMB enforces the process and has an incentive because it reviews those rules under the executive order, has an incentive not to undercount the costs. But
mm-hmm.
if we got to a world where we were in the RAINS Act and the executive branch were very significantly limited by congressional approval, I don't think we could trust OMB any longer.
Mm-hmm.
And so what does one do about that situation? And I would want to, first of all, require OMB to sign off on the rule. I'd want Congress to pass a law that would give some guidance as to how costs ought to be determined. But I think that those determinations should be subject to judicial review. By whom? By judges, these independent Article III judges who have
mm-hmm.
expertise as to economics.
Mm-hmm.
So OMB would make a determination, and if OMB said, oh, there's only $80 million, judges who know something about economics would be in some position to say, oh, no, that's not true. You're undercounting here, or you haven't taken this into account. So it would impose some discipline in the process. We don't really have time to go into it, but there's a variety of things I talk about that are that agencies could do. For example, if it's a $100 million cutoff, an agency could have two $60 million rules and therefore say, we're not going to have congressional review.
Right.
And one would need to have some checks there. There are other problems, and I have a variety of proposals to try to address them. Some are likely to work. Some of these are difficult issues to deal
mm-hmm.
with, but
mm-hmm.
but I think that the proposals would be much better than the existing RAINS Act, which basically punts on all of them. And
mm-hmm.
so I think before Congress actually enacted a RAINS Act, it really ought to do something like look at some of these problems and attempt to address them.
Yeah, and your article is great because it does go into a lot of depth. Like I think one actually solution that you have suggestion that you have is if the agency is trying to get around the major rule requirement by just splitting up the rules. If the rules come down within like a 3-year time frame, you say there's a presumption that it's actually the same rule, and so they have to show that it's actually different subject matters or something to be able to sort of prove that these are two separate minor rules. So the paper is just very in-depth, and again, it's called Classical Liberal Administrative Law in a Progressive World, and in it, Professor Rappaport goes more in-depth in explaining the Article 3 administrative judge proposals. And thank you, Professor Rappaport, for taking so much of your time today to talk to us about your proposals and to answer questions. We really appreciate it.
Thanks a lot, Professor Mascott. Really appreciate it. It was a lot of fun.
On behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank our experts for the benefit of their valuable time and expertise today. We welcome listener feedback by email at info@fedsoc.org. Thank you all for joining us. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.